Hello everyone and welcome to the least open world yet most skippable dev podcast in the world, House of Games. I'm your co-host Rune and today I'm joined by my host, Odo, and a very special guest, Mr. Paul Alvarado Mendoza. Before you introduce yourself, let us skip the rest and fast forward right into the House of Games.
Welcome everyone to the House of Games, and especially welcome to our guest Paul. So first of all, do you want to introduce yourself? Who are you?
Yes, thank you. My name is Paul Alvarado Mendoza, and yes, I am a service design manager today at a company called Sartorius, and I have been working with realizing ideas to a good product for 15 plus years. So that is the short introduction. I guess we will get into other stuff during the talks.
Yes, absolutely. And today's topic is project to succeed with them. So, and as I understand it, you have worked quite a lot with projects. So do you want to give us your like elevator pitch on how to succeed with a project from start to finish?
Of course. And I mean, this is a subjective thing sometimes, or an objective thing as well. So if you want to succeed, you need to measure what success is. That is the first tip I would give anyone. Because, I mean, if you start a project, any kind of project, it could be that you want to have a beach body 2025. Okay, how do you do that? First, you need to set expectations. What does that mean for you? Set a metric, and then you set up a plan, and then you go for it, right? So all these things are about setting the right expectations and the metrics, because then you can succeed with anything. An example is I started a company when I moved to Umeå, which was a new city for me. And I had no expectations of becoming the next Elon Musk or anything. My expectation was that I was going to use the company to increase my awareness in the network that I had and everything, not to become a millionaire. So when I, after 7 years, had up to 7 employees and felt that, okay, now I actually reached the success that I had, then I was done. Right. So it all depends on the expectations and the metrics that you set for success. For some people, that wouldn't have been a success. That would have been a failure even. That, okay, you gave up on your company. Oh, that is a failure. No, it wasn't a failure, because that was my metrics for success were achieved.
Yeah, very interesting. And on the topic of project, so what kind of projects do you like to do, or what sort of engages you with projects?
Exactly, and anything can be a project. What I like is to take something that is abstract, something that is like an idea, to encapsulate it into something that you need to deliver. That is what is fun with a project. So it could be anything. For example, when I was here in Umeå, I didn't know anyone. I had no network at all because I'm from Gothenburg. So I felt like, okay, I want to do something to help other people in my own situation, also to help myself. So I created a network called Luncheon. And I kind of said, okay, this is the idea and the project I'm going to do. So I set up some metrics. Okay, if I get people, more than 10 people to attend every week, then I'm actually achieving some kind of success, right? So I had the idea, and then I started doing something on LinkedIn and starting to share this and talk to people about it. And then it started to grow. And I remember we had even 2 meetings every week, and the average people coming to these meetings were 20 people per meeting. So taking something from an idea, something that isn't formulated, into something that where you realize the metrics. That is what I love.
You said that your first success was to get 7 employees and all that stuff, and then you mentioned something about giving up the company and all that. Did you set out a new goal after that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I would say that when I kind of felt that, okay, I was done with my own company. So when I took an employment at Sartorius, where I'm now, my goal was to be the best manager or UX designer in the company. So I set up another goal for myself, and maybe that wasn't so difficult because there are like 5 in the whole company. So, but still, I set up new goals, and also to kind of just do my job the best I can from that perspective. So it's always good to set new expectations and new goals.
Yeah, nice. And something that I think is common for issues with projects for people in the games industry is feature creep. I guess you've heard of it in the IT industry as well. So as our project guru, do you have any advice on how, is there a method to avoiding that? Because that seems to be sort of a self-perpetuating problem.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, feature creep exists because you don't know the actual requirements from the beginning. So you haven't set the expectations, or you know what is supposed to be done. And then when you work, you find a lot of stuff that, okay, this we didn't think about and that we didn't think about. And then you include that in the same feature, so to say, instead of, okay, these are good things. Again, ideas, put them somewhere else and focus on the thing that you were supposed to do. Because again, I mean, now we're talking projects. Sometimes I like to also talk products, because at the same time, I mean, a game is a product, right? So a project has limitations itself. A project ends, right? A product may live longer than a project. A project could be to reach the success to release the game, but the game then it continues living on, and it's a product. The thing with feature creeping is that the unknown unknowns come up, and then you try to fix them there and then. So I would suggest always in any type of project is to have focus, reach the goal of the feature that you have in mind, and then take everything else and put it into a new feature to continue work.
Yeah, as I think I've said on this podcast before, I'm making a game together with my brother, the guest in our last episode. And the first game we tried to do was, I think you could just summarize it as one big feature creep, because we wanted to do our dream game as our first game. And of course, we wanted to add multiplayer and crafting and the first person and third person perspective and pathfinding. And, you know, there was just so much, and we weren't even able to do 10% of it, probably. So for this game that we're doing, we still have a lot of ideas and things we want to do, but we've become a lot better at just saying, like, within 10 seconds of coming up with the idea, well, let's do that for 2.0. And then we can just save that idea and keep going with the core stuff.
I also had with Red Colony 1, 2, and 3. So the first game is they're all quite basic, but I kept on working on Red Colony 2. I just added stuff to the first one and then more stuff to the third one. And the game I'm working on now, I'm also thinking like that. There's a game I want to do more like a JRPG type of game. But I'm thinking already that the assets I'm working on now for my current game, pixel art and all that stuff, I'm already thinking if I wanted to use these assets for that game, I should keep that in mind. For example, this game I'm working on now, it's not fantasy or anything like that. So you have a police officer, for example. But then when I design him in Photoshop in pixel art, I sort of name layers and all that correctly. So when I work, if I were to start on that JRPG, which would be a fantasy game, I then can use this police officer's body, for example. But now I know this layer is the clothes and this layer is the leg, yada, yada, yada. And then I can quickly change that so it looks like a knight or a magician or something fantasy-like. So that's good advice, and that's something I personally learned from mistakes. So just grinding at my games, but eventually you sort of learn that over time. But I think that's a good advice to anyone who wants to start out straight away.
Yeah, and what you mentioned now is kind of what we call in IT, we call it maybe modularity. I mean, you know, when you make a system, you try to be thinking about how to reuse things or add things on it, right? So that it doesn't become a hassle, a lot of work to do that. Because right now at Sartorius, where I'm working, my team, we have the UX UI designers, we have architects, and we have the data scientists. These three competences are the competences that set kind of the requirements for what should be created, right? So we have control over the requirements in, and we have set of principles in every of these things. So UX, UI, we set principles. Okay, we want to have usability principles. We say easy to use. You have clear mental models of the world. You need to show visibility where you are in the system, and all these like heuristics that exist for usability. And I suggest everyone, even if you're a game designer and you say, I don't need to have usability because I'm doing a fun game, I'm like saying, okay, but if people can't even find where to click to go to the multiplayer tab, where do you start the game? And they feel confused. I mean, that is a bad experience. So how can they enjoy it if they can't even do the basic stuff?
That reminds me when I was a kid, I said, why learn English? I'm Swedish and I'm going to be a plumber. And now I have forgotten Swedish and I'm not doing plumbing. So,
okay, the Swedish Super Mario Bros.
Yeah, that's what I thought going into the plumbing school, that I would save princesses and eat mushrooms, but none of that really happened.
Another question I have is for a lot of indie developers as myself that does this as a hobby, we sort of tend to hit the ground running, that there's no real like planning for our project. We just go and start making a game, and things like feature creep and stuff comes up, and there's no preparation for that sort of thing. So could you give us a like helicopter view of the timeline of a project? So first you should plan, and then you should da da da, and then eventually you get to the end of a project, and you conclude it and so on. So could you give us something like that, if there is something like that?
Sure. I mean, there is something like that, and then it depends is my answer on that one. But of course, I mean, you have ideation phase. So ideation phase is the most fun phase, at least for me. I love to be creative. And that is the phase where you have ideas. You're like, okay, well, I want to do something that reminds me of, and then you can have a lot of games as references, or you can have services as reference apps. I don't, it doesn't matter, depending on what you're going to do, right? So you say, okay, I want to do something maybe like Zelda, because I love Zelda, you know, and what can I do there? And then you can have ideas. So the ideation phase, you have a lot of ideas and stuff. I would suggest for gaming that you also think about patterns during this phase. So, okay, what kind of patterns do I want in the game? So is it a platformer? Is it I don't know what. I mean, so you try to go from ideation to what the next phase is, where you try to crystallize it more into a actual concept. So for ideation, you just go crazy. Then you go to concept phase. That's when you start really thinking about, okay, what is going to be fun with this concept, right? And that's also where you can start experimenting. You can do prototyping, paper prototyping even. You can think of different things. Would this be fun? So you start with that early on. And when you pass the concept phase, that's when I would say you start going to a project phase. right? So the project phase where you plan stuff. And this, I think that here, when you go into the project phase, many are not prepared enough. I would set, for example, I mean, when we work with digital products in any way, we try to understand what is the value to the customer, right? Who is the customer? Who is the target group, right? There's no difference in games as in digital products. It's just that you need to think a little different. So who is the target group? What are their characteristics? You should set a set of principles. Also, I mean, what should you focus on when you go into the project? It could be that you want to have fast iterations to get feedback. You want to have it modular, that you, every step you take when you work, you think, okay, how could this scale? You maybe already think scalability, you think reproducibility, you think 2.0, you think about having a second game with the same concept, right? Storytelling, how do we work with storytelling? How do we work with onboarding? I mean, you can set a lot of stuff before you even start with the project to kind of set expectations on what is success, right? And then you go with the project. I would suggest, and this is maybe controversial because I know that in gaming people don't work this way, but I still don't understand why not. And that is to have, in my terms, we call it a customer journey. In gaming, it's not a customer per se. I would maybe call it a storytelling journey or a enjoyment journey where you have the phases of the game. What are the phases of the game? Because it's kind of like a book. You know, you usually say, what phases are there in the book? The beginning, the middle, and the end, right? I mean, it's no different, right? So in the beginning, in the middle, and the end, what phases do you have in the game? What is the goal, so to say, that a player should achieve? And how are the elements that make it fun to continue doing the same thing, right? So if you put it as a journey where you have these phases and then you say, for example, okay, I create my character and then I go out in the world and do stuff and then I meet monsters and then I do something else and I do something else. So you put a clear path of what you need from a storytelling perspective or journey perspective and then break that down into actually, okay, what does this mean for features? What do we need to develop to create this journey? So you map it out. So it's visual. How many of you have mapped out how your game is going to work from the beginning before you start working with the game?
I did something like that with Red Colony. I sort of have like, this is the start, this is how the game ends, and here's a twist somewhere here in the middle. And then what's happening between these stops or whatever. And this is also how I would visualize making games. If my company was big and I had employees and, you know, I was in charge of stuff, I would also visualize it. I'm sort of visualizing on a whiteboard, like this is the start and 25% into the game, this happens, 50% in this happens, 75% in this happens, and this is how it ends. And here are some Easter eggs, and then sort of leave it up to the team to fill in the blanks. And of course, have a dialogue if they want to change some of my ideas and so on. So I like that idea of sort of visualizing the whole game. Like literally, I had like papers taped together in a long line. And if you play Red Colony, you can tell it's just, you just walk from left to right the entire game. But anyway, so I like that idea. But I also struggle with that because then it becomes too much planning. And you said you don't want to become Elon Musk, which made me think about SpaceX. And the way they did the rockets was just like building them and sending them up. And then they exploded. And then they would like, ah, fuck, that didn't work. Let's try again. And some people, because I'm a bit of a space geek, so a lot of people sort of compare SpaceX with NASA, for example, or the European Space Agency or JAXA here in Japan. Like those space agencies, they plan too much and fucking nothing happens. While SpaceX just send out half-assed rockets to blow up. But at least they send something out, right? So the contrary to that would be like you just plan too much and then things just get stuck. Which, being Swedish and all that, you can sort of... I feel like it's... way too much of that in Sweden, like when they want Umeå, the city we're all living in, want the city to grow, but nothing happens. There's no buildings or anything. It's just everything is stuck. So my creative part wants to not have rules, because that's sort of creative freedom. And maybe that's why you said that the way, let's say you and I design games, you have sort of a rule set or a line like that. Maybe it is controversial because it's games, it's art, and it shouldn't necessarily have rules. But then again, if you don't have rules and all that stuff, nothing happens. It's just gonna be a bunch of hippies in a room throwing out ideas and no one fucking work on the game because it's just all over the place. So yeah, it's really, when I make games, at least I feel like I'm struggling with this all the time. Like sometimes I'm like, oh, god damn it, now I'm thinking about too many rules. Like I shouldn't do that. I should just do what my heart wants. So it sounds cheesy, but you know. So yeah, I don't know, maybe that's why.
It's a good comment. If you compare, okay, NASA and SpaceX, for example, I mean, it's also from a budgeting perspective, they might have different budgets, just to be also on that one. And also, I mean, of course, you can also just try stuff out and you could succeed, because I mean, that's also a thing that we do, but I want to do it in a way where it's controlled. I like to have some kind of control. And the thing you do is that when you've done this story thing, you can say, okay, if this is the beginning, the middle, and the end, you can say, to show the value with this, what would the smallest prototype that you can say, because you have mapped out the outline. It's not planning in detail. It's just the outline of the boundaries of where you should go, right? So it's not super like planning for 1 year. It's just setting some 10 principles. What is the outline of the project? You don't go outside the outline. But I mean, the thinking is that you don't go outside. But then if you feel that, whoa, something in this gave us such good feedback, then you can increase the boundaries. It's nothing stopping you. But if the world is open, you find possibilities, you keep yourself in the ideation phase forever. This is, again, the thing, right? So you want to go, the purpose of these phases is that you go forward as much as possible in the phases, but you still have ideation in the project phase as well, but you don't want to get stuck in the real first ideation phase where you just have a lot of crazy ideas. Like you said, you're not even building anything any longer because you're talking about so many ideas. So I agree with you that, I mean, I wanted to get feedback somehow. And how do you get feedback? By doing something, creating something. And the feedback that SpaceX gets is that it didn't work. I mean, that's their feedback. It's not from a customer or anything. It just exploded. Okay, why? And then they try to find out how to fix those things, and then they try again. So the feedback loop, super important. I agree with you.
I feel like I should have asked this before, but I want to ask anyway. It goes back to this setting out missions and succeeding with them. Have you ever set out a mission and failed? And how did you cope with that failure in that case?
It's a very good question. I mean, I've learned that failure is never a failure, because I learned something. So what I do, if I set out to, okay, I'm going to do the best lunch networking in the world, and then no one comes to my lunches, let's say that, okay. Then I say, okay, I failed. I could say that, but I'd rather not say that. Okay, what did I learn is the thing. Why didn't people come? Maybe I communicated with the wrong people. Maybe I was targeting the wrong group. Maybe I did it in a format where people couldn't make it. So it's about retrospecting what I've learned from this. It's not to say that, okay, it's a failure, because I mean, sure. And this is easy to say, because I mean, in life, you have real failures where you feel that it could take you 1-2 years to like get back again. But at the same time, now I feel that it's more like, okay, I tried something and that is actually worth something. Just to try and do, that is more important than to think about something in 10 years. Like, I want to build the game, and then you never do it. Just go and do it, because you're going to learn a lot. You're going to meet people. You're going to learn tools. You're going to get ideas in your baggage for the next time, for the next try. So it's never a failure. You're building something.
Absolutely. I agree with that advice. And something that I heard growing up from my parents, actually, that I always have brought with me that reminds me of this is that they said that failing is the fastest way to learn. And that's usually how I think about it as well. Because if you don't fail, that's going to take time to get to some understanding of what not to do. But if you fail quite quickly, then you learn quite quickly what is important in whatever task you're doing. So I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah. If you're a game developer who's just starting, like, we hear so many success stories in this industry and very few fail stories, if you will. But I agree, it's you never really fail. I mean, I sort of look at my first game, Knife Boy, as a failure, but I always keep reminding myself, like, Jesus Christ, even though it didn't do well or no one played it, fucking me, I learned how to make a game. Like, that's a skill I will never lose. I mean, I could have used the experience as a CV to work for a game company, maybe. But I think that we hear a lot of the success stories in the industry, and I can imagine that a lot of people, myself included, was very bummed out when nothing really happened after my first game. Yeah, that's what I also asked, like, how do you cope with that? Like, how do you, what do you guys would recommend for people who just set too high goals or they thought too much of their own product and then they came out to reality and it sort of like slapped them in the face?
Exactly. And I mean, in IT, we usually say big projects fail. So the bigger the project, the bigger chance of failure. I mean, there is like studies, one actually called the chaos study. And it's looking at projects from three perspectives. So it's looking from a budget perspective, from a timeline perspective, and requirement perspective, right? So that is what a project is. So from that perspective, 98% of the projects fail. Those 2% that don't fail is because they start small. And also have, again, metrics of expectation. I mean, for your first game, you should have expectation that one, you release it. That should be your expectation. You went all the way to the end goal. It's like, I'm gonna run a marathon. I don't usually train for it, but my for the first marathon I run, I shouldn't become the best. I should just enter the goal and I should just finish it. That is a success, right? And then after that, I mean, you can set up other, like, okay, for the second marathon I want to beat my first time and so on. But if you haven't even done your first thing, how can you ask yourselves to be successful? I guarantee that these people and these successes in the industry, they don't come by themselves. They have surely worked on other stuff before that, and they've done other things, maybe in other area. Maybe it wasn't games. Maybe it was other stuff. Doesn't matter. But the first success or the first thing should be just to finish something. And this goes for everyone, even Elon Musk. The people that are there, people talk about his great successes everywhere, and he does success. But the first one was the big one, because the first one was the one that set him to do the second one and the third one and the fourth one and the fifth one and the sixth one, and even doing the bad decisions that he's done. And maybe he learned from those, I hope, maybe not, I don't know. But you know, there is no perfection. Remember that, because there is no starting with why you want to build your dream game. I understand that, because you have passion, right? Passion and motivation is awesome. But the thing with that is also it's fragile, because if you set yourself that I'm going to climb Mount Everest, but you've never climbed, you don't have the body for it. Maybe you even have asthma. I don't know. You have a lot of stuff. And it's like, why set it so high? Just put a small hill. This is the first, I'm going to do this thing from beginning to end. And that is success.
So true with my experience with Knife Boy. It's just so damn ambitious for being a first time project and made by just solo developed. And I was so bummed out when it just was nothing, right? But then my next game is just, that was my first success. But it was just like, I set the bar way lower, because I felt like if I have that high bar again, it's gonna kill me. And it's annoying because my first game was a passion project and it's so much love poured into that game. And then Red Colon is just some big titted anime girl. And then there you go. It's unfair. God damn it. But it is what it is.
I think it's the target group thing maybe you did wrong in the beginning. No, but again, all these ingredients, it's not to say that you need to plan yourself to death, right? It's just that you have a direction, right? Where you go in, what you're trying to achieve, and you finish it. Because that is what you see with all the rest of the successes. They had a clear goal direction and they went for it and sure, during this path, they could find new ideas and stuff that they put in the game or they didn't put it in the game. For the next game, they will use them. So again, it's about having a clear direction and setting the expectations and the metrics for the success. And don't have too high expectations on success from the beginning. If you've never done a game, this first step is to create a game. That is a success.
Agree.
Exactly. I think me and my brother have, there is some feature creep going on because we said initially that, well, the last game was just full of feature creep. So this time our ambition is just to release a game. That's like we'll make the smallest game we can and then just release it. And that is still our goal, but I think we've gone a little more ambitious than that. But that is still what we're trying to do. So I think that's great advice. To go back a little bit on this topic, so you talked a little bit about the customer journey from IT. So for people to understand what that is about, could you give more of an explanation of how that works in IT so you could do a parallel to our industry?
Yeah, it's a method. And if you just Google customer journey, you will find like a template where you have different lanes, so to say, in a template. See, it's kind of like a Excel with rows. So what you have in the first row might be faces, right? Like I said, beginning, pre-boarding, reaching your goal, and then afterwards, right? So that you kind of try to understand what does the customer do before buying something or doing something, right? And then after you set those areas, then you go into, okay, what does the customer actually do? I mean, what step does the customer do to actually reach their goal, right? It could be that the first step is to log in, and then the second step is to try to find the feature I want to find, and then I want to do this, and then that, and then that. And so you map out the journey, so to say, the steps that that person takes to do something. And this could be done also in games. I mean, it could be, okay, how does a game start? When does the person go into the game? The journey could be, okay, how can you find ways to make the menu stuff just be simple, right? Because you want people to not get stuck in the menu. You want people to go into your game as fast as possible, because this could be done afterwards. You can look at your game and say, what is the journey of the game that I've created today? You can see first, someone needs to download the game, and then someone needs to log in the game, and someone needs to do this in the game. Then they need to do the settings, and then they need to do this and that and that and this and this and that. And then like for the 12th step, they're actually in the game. Then you can think, is this really what we want? Is this the journey we want to create for the customer? So that's just mapping out the activities when you play the game, right? And then you have another row underneath that where it's like, what are the pains for the customer for each step? Okay, the pain for login is that, okay, I never remember my password, blah, 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 whatever stuff. So you put out all the pains or the needs for the customer. And then you have one other row where you see also the experience. How did they experience each step, right? They find that the step of login is super terrible. That is very bad, right? So then you have another lane underneath a row where you have opportunities. So you ask the people when they play it, your game, and they log in. And they say, this experience is from, it's a 1 of 5 in experience. It's terrible. And then you ask them why? Not because I like it not to be a login. Okay. And then you think, why do I have a login? Do I need a login? Maybe something I can remove as a step. Just examples, you know, so you find opportunities in all these steps that you have. How can we make it better? How can we make the experience even better for them? It could be anything in the game as well. I mean, steps like, for example, if you have crafting in your game, as an example, where people try to find recipes and stuff like that. Okay, it's hard to search for them. It's hard to find the right one. So, or you even have the gamers need to remember the recipes. I mean, stuff like that. And it's a terrible experience. Then maybe the opportunity is, okay, why are we giving them this challenge to remember stuff? Is that part of the game mechanics, or is it just that bad usability? I mean, do we need a feature that actually gives them, like, you can pin your favorite recipes or whatever, right? It's all about finding these opportunities for making the game a more enjoyable thing all the time. And that is what you would use the customer journey for, is to map all the activities out to say, okay, where can we make improvements? Because since you're not a UX designer in the beginning, maybe you don't even have a UX designer type of person in your studio or in your way of working anything, then you don't have this. So the customer journey can support you to do this yourself. Because me as a designer, I think about this out of the box directly. I map it up in my head, these things, and think of ways to improve.
As soon as I need a password to play a game, I'm out. I hate passwords. We're going to make an episode of House of Games in the future when I'm just going to sit and rant for 2 hours about how much I hate passwords, apps, all this shit. It drives me up the fucking walls. As soon as it's like, you forgot your password, and I'm like, well, and there's 2 authorization codes and an SMS to my phone, and it's a old phone. All of that drives me batshit crazy. But you mentioned a little bit before we started, like the types of games you have, and you don't have the patience, or we sort of agree maybe it's because we are fathers and we just don't have the time. But I'm thinking, now you also mentioned that you think about these things out of the box, and one of the discussions that is out there in the gaming industry now is like God of War Ragnarok and Horizon Zero Dawn 2. There are puzzles in these games, and they barely give you like 20 seconds before some fucking NPC in the game is going to go, "Oh, you might want to open the window." It's like they don't give you a chance to even try, right? And this is so I hear like arguments from both sides, like they shouldn't have these hints because it's a puzzle. And then the other one is like, well, they shouldn't tell the hints so fast. And I think maybe there's like some in between, that you could go into the settings and turn off the hints or something like that. Because personally, I wonder, like, why do we have these puzzles in the games if they're just gonna spoil how to solve them after like 2 seconds of thinking? Or you mentioned like having crafting in a game, and people have to remember the recipes and all that stuff. But then, what is the point having the crafting in the game? Why not just hit the craft button? I'm curious what you think about that, and also, do you think it has something to do with how gamers are just becoming more and more spoiled in terms of things just have to be faster and faster? I talked a lot about this on House of Games before, about this sort of on-demand culture. We get everything on demand. There's no waiting. There's no, like, I think the overall patience level have gone from 12 seconds to 8 seconds or something like that. Do you think that can also have something to do with it? How would you solve that so we can sort of please the impatient people and the people like me who really enjoy the puzzles? But at this point, I'm not gonna play God of War until they patch that shit, because I want to make sure I don't get disturbed. I want to sit there and figure it out.
Those are valid questions, and there's no simple answer. It depends, again, I will say that. But one thing that you could do from the beginning is, I mean, I talked about kind of personas or target groups. There's also something called archetypes, where you group people after behavior or something else. It could be, for example, that you really want to solve these puzzles yourself. Mm. You like the challenge. Those people that like the challenge. And then you have people that don't like the challenge, for example. So if you mark out who are the people that will play your game, and then you think about that step, again, in the customer journey, again, the mapping out, the step when you do the puzzles, then you can say, who are the people that are going to play this? Okay, it's both of these. Okay, how do we do it so we balance it out for them? Then you could have, like you say, that you don't get it automatically. You need to go somewhere to actually ask for it. Right? then it doesn't, maybe doesn't affect you that you want to solve it yourself. But at the same time, if you really, really tried and you got stuck, you might go and do the same thing as the person that doesn't have any patience, right? So you can still do the same thing for both archetypes, and you solve the problem instead of having a setting, because again, that is adding also what the best code is no code. The best app is no app. The best blah, blah, blah is no blah, blah, blah. I mean, don't add stuff to add stuff. If it's not supposed to give value, don't add it. Don't do it. Absolutely. Why? Why do you do it? Just because it's like, oh, okay, we put a setting. Oh, no, but why? So fix it instead of in the game, because then it's like, okay, you have a million settings then later on, and no one will find the settings because you have so many settings. I mean, so you're not solving the issue. You're just putting it somewhere else where you need to have the user or the player to understand where it is. So you're doing the same mistake, but in a different place instead. So again, who is the player? What did you think that they need or know that they need? And then you need to balance that out, because then you can do research. Okay, you have one of these people that are super patient and love puzzles. You have that as a focus group or a group that you tested this idea out on. You prototyped it, you tested, and they love it. Good. And then you have the other group doing the same thing and they love it. Good. And maybe they don't love it. Okay, why don't you love it? No, it's because I didn't understand that I needed to go to the NPC to ask. Ah, we need something called affordance, which means in design languages to show somehow where you need to go to do something, right? Or this button is clickable. It's affordance. You show it with like maybe a border or something, you know, that's affordance, where you tell the user that, okay, here is something, right? Maybe you do it by, I don't know, having a border on the NPC character or a bubble saying that, can I help you? Or whatever, and you can go and ask it, right? So you try to build the affordances so that it becomes apparent in the game. You don't need to Google it, right? Oh, how do you do it? Oh, okay, you needed to do that because it's so apparent that you needed to go talk to the NPC. Super simple to understand, right? So again, who who is the target group? Who are the players? But I agree totally with you. The patience and stuff has disappeared. I mean, especially with mobile, I mean, if it takes too long time to do something or to get into the actual application or do the things that I need to do, I have no patience. I delete the app and download another one. I mean, we all have this thing. And also for games, I mean, like I said in the beginning, I don't think that was recorded, is that I love board games. It's super fun. You're with people, you eat chips, and you have a lot of fun, and you joke, and you do. It's fun, but it's so time-consuming. I mean, 6 hours, and then maybe you didn't even take two steps in the world, and it's like, okay, guys, next time. And it's like, what? I mean, in a PC game, we could do the same setup, but digitally, and we maybe could even dungeon crawl or whatever a couple of times to actually enjoy. So again, what is enjoyment? I didn't enjoy the 6 hours that much from a play perspective. I enjoy it from a social perspective. So is that a failure in the game? Yeah, maybe. Maybe not. I don't know. So again, what is success? What is not? It depends on the group. That board game is not done for my group because I don't have the time. I don't have the patience, and that is not an enjoyment for me, sitting 6 hours and not getting anywhere. If you have that in mind, I mean, doing a board game is for those people that love that stuff, not for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that we've touched a little bit, I guess you could call it the gamer journey, perhaps. I think that's absolutely something that you can take with you. So for me, I also hate when tutorials have, instead of, for example, Half-Life is a very good example of show, don't tell for tutorials. For example, they show the boss that you're gonna meet in 2 hours, just a glimpse of it, so you get an idea of what it is you're gonna be doing. And then you see perhaps an NPC expose a weak point or something, so then you will get ideas in your head, and then it's still gonna be some time before you actually do it. But some games, they have like menus and I think for me, fighting games are notorious for this, for me, because you just want to mash in buttons and just try it out, but instead you have a pop-up for every move that a character can do with the tutorial for some fighting games. So I absolutely think it's something that a lot of people who makes at least tutorials can take with them to just scale it down to what is actually important.
I'm thinking the Half-Life example there. The cool thing with that is, I mean, surely that must be hard to design, because otherwise I feel like, for example, Ragnarok, they should be able to design it so that I feel like I'm solving the puzzle with ease. But you talk about, like, who's the game for, like the focus group and something like that. Then I wonder who the fuck was the focus group who played God of War, who thought it was a good idea to hint everything after 2 seconds. So it's either like that focus group is like some sort of echo chamber of like-minded people, but obviously I don't think like they do, because I want to be challenged with the puzzles. Or the game design is just not good enough, because I guess there would be a middle ground where the puzzles, I don't know, like, because I really enjoy when there's a puzzle and I sit there for like 10 minutes trying to figure it out. I know in Uncharted sometimes they have like a hint button, so you can press the hint button, but even that I find like, now the hint button came up, so then I'm sort of, I kind of want to press the hint button. But I really enjoy puzzle games when I really get to solve them myself. But I do understand that that's obviously not most people. It must be really hard to design that. So it is like in Half-Life where they show you the weak point, for example, on a boss. And when you meet the boss, you know the weak point, and then you feel really smart for figuring it out, even though it sort of showed you previously. That must be really difficult to balance and get right, I suppose.
Exactly. And again, it's planning. Planning is the word. You plan for this kind of experience from the beginning. You don't just lay it on afterwards. I would even say that it's almost impossible, because if you haven't had this plan on how you will do this kind of affordances and show these things, like kind of Half-Life, like you said, they planned it where to do these things from the beginning, so that when you are in the situation, you have been prepared, right, to understand how you should solve it. So I think that, again, it's about the journey, it's about preparation, and it's about planning this from the beginning, because sometimes you don't even think about these things at all. And then you're there and you have a puzzle, and then the way to solve it is to just add a hint button, right? Okay, they can't do it, so we add a hint button after 10 minutes, right? The focus groups things is about different behaviors. If you find this focus group with people like you, I think that they would say the same things as you, because that is the purpose of this. Not to find a focus group that has all of them. That won't work. You need to focus on the different groups per se, right? But if you have a group with everyone, all of them, they will say different things. It's going to be really confusing for everyone. But you need to get feedback from each group per se. You want all the groups to like your game. Or you say, my game is not for this group. For the ones that really, they don't have patience. That group is not my group, for example. I will never show a hint. Of course, that group will not like your game, but you have made a design decision. You have made an active decision to not include them in your game, because that is also in your power. If you try to design something that will work for everyone, it will work for no one. Take that with you, because that is what they are trying to do. They try to broaden the groups. So to try to cater to everyone, and then they piss everyone off, right? Because they don't cut the groups out. They say, no, we want the people that like puzzles, and we want the people that are bad at puzzles, but still would like puzzles. And then we have the impatient people, and we have the patient people. Yes, let's do this.
Yeah, I think that's true. And ranting about God of War. In that case, I really think they should just get rid of the puzzles altogether, because there's no point having them there at all, since they tell you what to do straight away. And the same with Horizon. But I'm quite curious if this would be a cultural thing. I was just thinking now that, talk about focus groups and stuff like that. Due to internet and algorithms and so on, we seem to fall into different camps politically or morally or whatever online. So let's say that in each country you have sort of different camps because of how internet works, and it sort of connects us with sometimes with like-minded people. So I wonder how that focus group, it would be interesting to have a focus group from Europe, from United States, from Japan, for example, and then see how they approach the same problem. Because I think that even if you have a focus group and they are like-minded in, let's say, Sweden as an example, but then you have the sort of Swedish culture sort of sneaks in there as well, that is nothing like American culture or Japanese culture. So I guess having focus groups from different parts of the world would be maybe the best approach to get as wide of an opinion as possible. But then I do also agree with you that at some point you just have to say, well, this game is not for you, so.
And I agree with that. I mean, I did some research with cultural differences for automotive industry over 15 years ago. Exactly, this was the thing. I was in different parts of the world, so U.S., Europe, and Asia, and we had the same kind of design for different cultures. And you notice that the culture different was they were so different. So they used this design in totally different ways, and they felt totally different when interacting with the design. So I agree, but like, which culture are you trying to reach, right? You can't reach everyone, because if you try to design for every culture, it's not going to work. Like you said, this game might not be for you. And the thing that you need to say is, this game is for you instead of the other way around. This game is for you guys, right? Instead of excluding people. So this game is for you that likes hard puzzles, that likes blah, blah, that likes. Instead of the other way around, okay, maybe this game is not for you. And of course, you can always try to broaden the group afterwards somehow, but maybe not with that puzzle part of the game. Maybe with something else, because the archetypes, you have the explorers, you have the challengers, the achievers, the blah, 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 all these types of people that like different parts of the game. And one example is Pokemon Go. I like that as an example because I wanted to test Pokemon Go out because I wanted to understand the enjoyment, right? And then I noticed that they did like a small slice for different kinds of these archetypes. So the explorer, they could go around the world and explore, right? So that was a part of Pokemon Go. And then you had these camps where you clicked like a crazy person to do battles, right? And that was not for me. I was like, this is not even skill. So I was like, this is not for me. And then you had the achievers, the one that needs to find all of the Pokemon, right? Or unlock achievement. That's what's their purpose of the game, right? So what Pokemon Go did very well is to try to cater for all of these in the game with different activities, right? So in God of War, I have not played that, so I cannot say so much, but one of these things could be done for advanced puzzle players that love puzzles, right? Another part is for the people that think that puzzles are too hard. Maybe you have some other activity that's more for them. So it's again about designing, putting together what is actually that you want to have in your game and for what group.
And I think that's a good wrap up since we're coming up on about 1 hour. I want to thank you so much, Paul, for joining us. And before we end the episode, is there anything you want to plug or promote or anything like that?
Thank you. I would say add me to LinkedIn so you can find me, Paul Alvarado Mendoza. I want to give a shout out to my friend that's done a board game called League of Dungeoneers that was kickstarted. He's going to do a Kickstarter soon again for a reprint and an expansion that is going to go out maybe in a month or two. So I want to give a shout out for that, and hopefully that will be available in a digital format for me.
Very interesting, and you're most welcome back to the show to talk more about that. Sometimes I wish these episodes were 2 or 3 hours long because there's always so much to talk about, but that would be very interesting to hear more about. So we'll make sure to send links to those things in the description of this episode. And thank you, Paul, again. Thank you, Rune, for being my co-host as always, and thank you everyone for listening.